Hi, Jack.
Hi,
I'm so happy to be speaking with you and Michael today.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, number one, you're with Formosa, Jack. I have to talk to anybody. Jack, nobody does sound work as well as Formosa does. And on this project in particular, Masters of the Air, you guys blew me away.
Thank you. Yeah, we it was a very special project.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Michael.
How is everybody today?
Well, I'm talking to
Good.
two artisans, gurus from Formosa, so I'm fine.
Thank you very much.
Anytime I get to talk to any of you from Formosa, I'm a happy girl, let me tell you. I have to congratulate both of you and your teams. The sonic soundscape of this entire project, all 9 episodes, is, I think, one of the best examples of sound design, mixing, editing that I have ever heard. Be it
Wow, thank you so much.
films going back to the golden age in the 30s, 40s, 50s, right on up through the high tech that we have achieved in the last couple of decades. This is unparalleled excellence.
Beautiful, thank you.
It just amazed me because of the whole project, not just because of the historical accuracy of it, but the historical accuracy went beyond the characters, beyond the story, beyond the cinematography, beyond having two B-17s there. It extended into the sound with the authenticity of B-17s. I think the 190s, the interior sound that you bring to life of those guys in a B-17 flying over the ocean is just amazing because we're getting different mic tones, we're getting different radio and comms notes in there. We're hearing switches being clicked, and then we've got in the gunnery seat, we're up in the cockpit. You've got wind shears that you can hear because it's not like getting on a plane today. You can hear the wind out there in many instances. Plus, as they're being fired upon, you hear the breathing of each of the guys. You hear the shrieking as they're hit. It is just a cacophony of brilliance. And I don't even know how you put this together. So, start at the beginning. Where did you even start with this project because of the level of authenticity that you wanted to achieve and did achieve?
And all this stuff. So that was the starting point of that conversation.
conversation, and then it's like, how do we do that? After that point, we were able to start building our library, our soundscape, and then we worked with Apple and Playturn, and we went and got access to a plane in Arizona, which was just amazing, and we got to go and record that plane. So Mike and I and our crew went there for, we were there for, like, I think it was like 4 days, I think, and we had access to this, we had great access to this flying B-17, which is quite a rare thing these days, and then we just recorded everything we could record, from the interiors to the exteriors, on the runways, at different speeds, RPMs, and then we also recorded the thing in flight and flying overhead. And then from that, we took that library, made a new library, because we always want to have fresh material.
Mm-hmm.
But that always brings a new flavor. You always want to try and have a fresh material because it gives new flavor, right? So the audience hasn't heard that stuff before. So we did that. And then our team worked to build that together. And we worked on the design and building that out. And then from that point, right, Mike, we saw where we needed to go with it and how to impart more character to that feeling of those scenes, of being on board with the crew. And then we just took it from there, really.
Wow.
Yeah, but the B-17 was a big undertaking, and it was a team of six guys. They had four multi-track recorders. RXT microphones planted on the 17 in flight and on the ground, and recorded every possible thing that made sound with engines running and without. And so we had a very extensive library built from that. Of course, from there, everything gets sweet and accessorized to make it even better, because we have to tell this story and put so much emotion into that airplane, and that's filled with horror and fear and terror. That was our goal, was to make the plane just a really scary beat. And these guys are preparing me for the last time they go off. So that was our mind going, how to.
The B-17 is its own character in this film, and that's something that I found very striking. And part of that character is the dialogue and is the communication that we're hearing through devices within the plane itself. While you were in Arizona getting B-17 sounds, did you have the opportunity or think about putting a person, like, in the gunnery seat, in the pilot seat, and actually record to get the modulation and interference or clarity of speaking through devices within the confines of the plane?
No, we put people in and microphones in, but we didn't do any recordings of vocalists in any location. That was all a recreation of our own.
Wow.
Based on recordings that were made on production, we used a guy. We didn't use the recordings themselves because we wanted them to be better. The recordings that were made over radio and through the mast and sitting beside the fuselage of the plane, those were very, very less, not so much what we copied.
Mm-hmm.
Your characteristics is what we copied.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mike worked on a lot of that. Mike recreated he spent a lot of time with dialogue change and secret source and reverb change and to emulate those spaces with a real thing. And then there was so much dialogue changing all the time on the production, and new ideas and new lines being written. It was an ever-evolving thing, so we couldn't be locked into having a static recording that was a one-off thing. Mike mm-hmm. was always tweaking and tuning the voices as it was needed for each moment.
Wow, this must have been a real pain in the butt with ADR and with looping.
Oh my God! Well, there's like 5,000 in this film, and speaking parts. A lot of that had to be redone. Some of it had to be done because of noise.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it had to be done on stage where they wanted to improve their performance. So as the story started to take shape in the editing room, dialogue changes were made constant. Every year that we were on it, that's always changing.
Mm-hmm.
We became very fluid in our approach of how to handle all of those recordings to make fluid. So elements had to be very careful applied. And then 20 days of group recordings. dozens of people speaking many different languages that sprinkled out throughout.
Oh my God.
So, a lot of dialogue is in that movie.
And of course, aviators have their own language between them. All the call signals, the codes, that's another whole. So it's not an easy thing to think that they might be saying this, the dialogue might be this. You've got to also interpret, like a foreign language, interpret the aviation language as well.
Correct. There were ads living on. Everything that was put into the film, some of the group lived. Recordings, but anything that really necessary for self-correct or supervised a military user wasn't way at all. We were told what to say and how to say it.
Wow. Well, considering that Hanks and Spielberg were behind this, I am not surprised to hear this at all, because they are meticulous, especially Hanks when it comes to honoring the service and history. Not surprised at all. Wow. Now, did you ever go into Donald Miller's book itself? Because I've read the book, and when you read the book, you also get a lot of flavor of the sounds that were being experienced by the pilots, be it in the air, on the ground. So I'm curious if you gleaned anything from the book itself.
Yes, we always, that was our, we both, Mike and I, when we were at the very beginning of the project, we both got a copy of the book, and we also got a copy of the audio book, and we, used it in great detail, because everything you need to know is in that book. It's a masterpiece of work. And we referred to that a lot. And we referred to a couple of other books as well that were used for technical jargon that were advised to us by the executive producers and the military advisors in order to try and be as authentic as possible with all of the minutiae of life, both on the plane and in the airbase. We were always trying to convey that authenticity and be accurate to the time.
I was just going to add, if we ever questioned ourselves or were confused about the tech issue and its authenticity, we had advisors on call all the way, every single day until the final day of the mission. Turned it over to Apple. They were always at the other end of a phone for any equipment we had.
That is great. In addition to the planes, inside the planes, outside the planes, another big task that you had were the bombings and then being on the ground and a concentration camp and just the sounds of landing in a desolate field in France or somewhere else or on a desert beach. How was your approach to all of the groundswell audio and developing that soundscape? And particularly with the different battles, because we are hearing different bombs and things going off, and you don't want it to be a single note cacophony from one battle, from the Battle of Munster to another one, to Nuremberg. So I'm curious your approach to differentiating that as well as the different locales on the ground.
Emotional and just, you don't just put a sound on this supplement something. That's how we approach this at all. Every purpose. So whether we're on the ground and things are calm or on and things are chaotic or was our goal using text, dialogue and music to gain an emotional training and just to value. Jack, you can take it from there.
Yeah, exactly what Mike was saying. It was always about the emotion and you know, like to use the example of the concentration camps, we played around a lot there with the density or density of the background and life, or desolation, depending on how we wanted to tune each of those scenes, because they go through their own real emotional arc. They're in the camp for, I think, 18 months, and they go through a big swing themselves and how they're feeling, and we sort of played that within those last three episodes. Between giving the sense that there's life or there's still the military machine is still working within the prisoners and they're not losing hope, or in the case of Egan in episode 8, he really does start to come apart for a little bit, and we definitely wanted to sell that icy cold freezing tundra thing that's going on in the winter in Germany, and then going through to the death march in episode 9,
mm-hmm.
and then going to the other wider camps where we come into all the different branches of military from the different nations where they all come together, and we have a camp of tens of thousands, and we really wanted to, we recorded a lot of loop group there with different languages and different characters, whether it was French or Polish or Dutch, and we just wanted to convey all of this rich feeling of all of the different prisoners that were there, and the life that was going on. Yeah, every scene was its own different task, its own different thing to work out, and yeah, everything was a very unique. The stuff on the ground is as busy as the stuff on the air.
Mm-hmm.
As funny as that sort of sounds, because we didn't want to just do big scenes in the air and then, you know, dialogue scenes on the ground. We were always trying to keep the storyline going, so we really did do that.
Yeah, and keep the danger on. There's the Stalag Loop 3, where Bucky are at with their group of people, and maybe 1,000 people there, prisoners. But it's also desolation, as Jack was saying. It's the winter. There's danger. There's guards. There's dogs. Then you're approaching. Off in the distance, then you're approaching Russian American army getting closer, and then that's when the Germans decide to move the prisoners and to consolidate them. We don't know it at the time. By the time we get to Moosburg, prison that's condensed different prisons into one large encampment of 110,000 men. And so our guys don't know what happened at that point. Are they all going to die? Are they going to be murdered?
Mm-hmm.
To evidence? Or are they going to send
Mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, on the Death March, I loved the attention to the little details, such as the creak of tanks coming in one direction, a wheel, even mucking in the mud, walking through mud at certain points, and the stop at the one concentration, at the one camp that had been burned out, and you see the charred bodies. The lack of sound there, the silence, but for a set of footsteps, is chilling. On every level, you hit every emotional beat from a sonic standpoint. And I find that so amazing. How long did this whole process take you for just for the sound of Masters of the Air?
Well, we were on it, Jack and I. The South was over a 15-month period with a couple of books, hiatuses, and so we had lots of opportunity. The fact that it was always being taken out and brought up and updated did so much. Talk about it, and as well did the hiatuses. When we went down for a week, we had time to and come back with ideas, and, or how can we make it more. That's really was our greatest ally. We had time for the project.
Mm-hmm. And that's a luxury you don't often get.
Never.
Do you have any idea how many different sounds of armament, of ammo, of bombs? How many different types of sounds you were using for that?
A lot. we were over just in the different grouping. I think we were at about we also tried to. I will say we tried to be as because there's so much in this thing. We tried to be as precise as we could be,
mm-hmm.
rather than cover everything with a million sounds, so we always try to cut it very tightly, otherwise it would have been an overwhelming amount of material, but nonetheless I think we were still in 16 different groups for different types of sounds up in the air,
mm-hmm.
and then six or eight types of background and hundreds of quite a large amount of loop group as well. It was definitely a lot of material, which was handled
like I was
very
saying,
well by Dunn and Mike.
Yeah, I mean, the effects and dialogue at I think it really helps process.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it gets to us on the mix stage, I've already talked to them about it. I know what we're being fed and are in front of us. So we just start through it from there. And if you're right, we tell you it's just a matter of choices. When you're in the mix, the editor's thing pretty much that they're giving us is going to work. The music department, the sound effects department, the dialogue department, you have time to think, and they give us what they think is going to work. And that's a great advantage. When it gets on the stage, we have to make it work, and that's when we do, a whole other level of decision.
Mm-hmm.
Those two time, those two chunks of decision make, as we had the time, we could do it.
At what point in time did you get the music to lay in for this one?
All right, so about a quarter of the way in the mixing process, which means we made our first test. Our past another two is when we had our first music show up, and we had to start considering what music content was going to make it and what it wouldn't. How was it going to play a particular scene? What parts of the orchestra could we use? This went on with the department, with the composer, the mixer, who would play course about 50. Some of these episodes had 25 passes.
Wow.
And every pass, it was different decisions being plotted. So the music department made just as much sound as the sound effects department and the dialogue department. Everything is changing all times. So everything has to remain fluid. The music department did a tremendous job of coming up with new ideas, new recordings. They recorded many different sessions. They approached all this differently. I mean, some scenes were so good right from their first shot, they were left alone. And other scenes, it became apparent that dialogue or sound effects, a specific moment, made me more important. Music is important. Everything's shifting at all times, every single second. What's going to work? And that becomes more and more evident the more you go through it all.
Mm-hmm. What would each of you say was the most challenging aspect of creating the soundscape for Masters of the Air? If you had to name one specific area that was the most challenging for you, what would that be?
Jack, go ahead.
Okay, I need a second to think on that one.
I'll just name one for you. Thinking there, Jack. There were a few challenges for me. I was handling the dialogue and the music, so I have to look at it that way, and then I also have to look out in the overall scheme. We're going to fit the effects in here. So I'm the one who's having to take a look at the big lands at all times. Is the story working properly? Is it emotional? There's like 5, 7 big that were challenging. One of them was the first time we're ever up in thing in episode 1. In the middle of a battle, they were doing a nosedive, and it was the first time our audience was going to hear it. And we played that scene so many different ways until we felt that it was emotionally correct. There's other scenes throughout that were just as challenging. They weren't quite emotionally correct. I always had the sound. We had the dialogue, we had to, but until you hit it, when you know that it's correct, there's so many scenes like that, including the one at the episode 9 when Buck finally in the camp in Moosburg, and the Americans start to guard encampment to fight, and Bucky, this is his moment to raise the flag of the American. I mean, huge moment. And that was played a different way. Whether it's crowd, it's offstage gunfire, it's bomb, it's paint, it's music, it's all, it's everything. And it's more of men. So what do? We just, it's a balancing act. And that we did it 100 times differently until we felt, this is what feels right. So those are the you'd have someone.
Those 2 points that Mike mentioned were definitely a challenge. I think also the challenge was always, in broad strokes, keeping the plane alive throughout very, long scenes up in the air, and trying to keep them, keeping the audience involved with being inside the plane. As an overall concept, I think that challenge was the one where we were trying to be, we tried to do something different with this show, with this project, and keeping these monster engines alive all the time, and hearing the metallic rattles and the groans and the shrieks, and just the whole that there is, even when it's quiet, it's not quiet in this show, and that was a real challenge for sure.
Well, I will tell you that hearing the creaks and the groans and everything with the B-17 engines, that really heightened the emotional experience for me, because it makes you wonder. It's like you think this thing is going to fall apart when you're hearing the shrieks and the groans and all, which makes it even more of a wonder and a marvel at what these bombers did in the war. And how they pulled off everything. That, the sound that you have, for me, it heightened the entire emotional experience. And every time a plane is starting, or I'm hearing it in the air, it's like, is the engine going to fall out? They probably held up better than the planes we've got in the air today, obviously. But it really, for me, and I've watched the whole series through twice now, it's that level of detail. And those tiny little things that you captured and brought to life that made it a living and breathing thing and really heightened the awe of the entire series and of history itself. Just brilliant, guys. Brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
This has been such a joy getting to speak with you about Masters of the Air. You are truly masters of sound. How are you going to top this project? Guys, I can't thank you enough. This has been wonderful getting to speak with you. And it is safe to say Masters of the Air is my favorite series of the year, and I don't see anything else topping it. It's amazing.
Great.